Today's episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. Get the latest long reads, case updates, and fantasy casting in your inbox every weekday by signing up at bestevidence.fyi. Got no cash? Us either, but the newsletter's mostly free these days, and we would love to have you join us. And now, the episode.
You do one story a week, you made the exact same money. That's it.
Look, Art, it's not about the money, all right? It's about my process.
All right.
You and your process get together, do one story a week.
What is the role of the free press in popular crime? That question's probably above our pay grades, but both of the scripted films we're talking about today examine that question from different angles. First, we're getting meta in the Most Wanted section with 2020's Most Wanted, which casts as its hero Canadian journo Victor Malarek in the story of the internationally overcharged Alain Olivier and proves cop bungling and cover-ups are NAFTA-wide. Then we go all the way back to 1956 and a take on the William Hirons case that suggests that sometimes the effort to make a murder a story is the story. Hike your pants up to your armpits and get ready for a bunch of citizen kind jokes. It's The Blotter Presents, episode 155. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that looks at how true crime is told and sold. My guest today does both with me every weekday and beyond. It's Best Evidence publisher and fellow non-Zodiac descendant, Eve Scoop Beatty. Welcome back, Eve.
Well, thank you, Sarah.
Thank you so much for joining me for what was almost inadvertently, at least on my part, a double shot of journalist crime-solving docudrama. Let's get into the metaist Most Wanted section we've had to date with Most Wanted. This is the still in quote theaters. It is on video on demand / virtual cinemas. We'll have some links in the show notes if you'd like to watch it. You may want to reserve judgment until after we've talked about it. This is the one with Josh Hartnett with long hair and at 70s styled mustache, even though this takes place in like 89. Anyway, here's the case file from the film's justwatch.us landing page. Quote, ex-heroin junkie Daniel Leger gets involved in a drug deal with the wrong people for the wrong reasons. When the deal goes sour, Daniel gets thrown into a Thai prison and slapped with a 100-year sentence. While he tries to survive his Bangkok incarceration, the news of his conviction captures the attention of Globe and Mail journalist Victor Malarek, who decides to go after the shady undercover cops responsible for wrongly accusing Daniel, end quote. It's not exactly an accurate summary of the plot. But anyway, Malarek, played with mustachioed brio by Josh Hartnett, and I still would, not proud of it, is a real person. Leger is based on Alain Olivier, who spent nearly a decade in a Thai prison thanks to an op that, if it is portrayed even partly accurately here, got a high-ranking Canadian cop's kid killed, possibly by the Canadian cop, and it seemed to exist in the first place only to justify its own task force's budget. This also stars Jim Gaffigan as a racist party lout and confidential informer. There's a lot going on. Okay, I'm not even sure where to start, so let's start broad and then iris in on some things. Generally speaking, on a scale of the paper to Zodiac, where would you put this? Do you think this goes in like the Hall of Fame of like journo crime docudrami or scripted biopics or no?
Well... Here's the thing. A lot of these sort of like bullshitty, like irritating things about these crusading journalists are accurate. And it becomes a chicken and egg thing. Like, you, I mean, what I always think about is, you know how there was the whole wiretapping thing where the mobsters were basically building a lot of what they were doing on stuff they'd seen on The Sopranos?
Uh-huh.
I've frequently wondered if, like, sort of the investigative journalists that I've known, especially the old school guys, the guys who would have been contemporaries of the Josh Hartnett character, even if the Josh Hartnett character had been in the 70s, you know, and they're swashbuckling, you know, not being around when your wife has a baby sort of bullshit. If that came from movies like the movie we're going to talk about in the cold case section, or if this is just what these people are like and these movies are accurate. But the point of all this is that all the dumb stuff that Josh Hartnett says in this movie, where you're like, yeah, that sounds nice. Yeah, I would love to not have a byline for 2 months. These people were saying this still when I worked at a newspaper in 2006. Like, I think that they've sort of, you know, if you've seen Gone Girl, you know how that went. They all got laid off at some point shortly after that. But back there were loads of people who were like, my process, and I'm working on a story. I'll have it for you in 3 months, and I expect it to be on the front page and stay by the facts and all that. I mean, these people are real people, and the eye-rolling things that he said are almost all things that I heard said in newsrooms by sort of the last vestiges of the old guard.
Yeah, that sounds about right. I sometimes wonder how much all the President's Men and just Watergate coverage generally informed not just the newspaper man's sense of self, but also the depictions of journalism and reporting on screen, like in the scripted space, even if it's a true story, that you have to have this like Bernsteinian person who, it first of all, is functioning as a cop in some ways, and second of all, is like, he's the center of the story, like he is the story because he is writing the story.
Well, but isn't that, there was a place that had layoffs the other day, a public radio station in San Francisco had some layoffs, and I texted my friend who worked there and I said, oh, are you okay? And this was sort of her first media job. And she's like, why are people reporting on this so much? Why do people keep writing about it? Everyone's having layoffs right now. It's the pandemic. And I'm like, because journalists are obsessed with journalism jobs.
Yeah.
And so they're going to write about the media, and they're going to write about layoffs at, this is KQED, KQED, before they're going to write about layoffs at whatever, like Oracle Park even, you know, or something like that. You know, they're going to go to that first because it's about, I think that's one of the main reasons that we see like the journalist is saving the world, because it's, you know, that's also the right, what you know, right? That's the world, you know, everyone knows the newsroom and all that. It's rare that you see a lawyer who writes a story about being a lawyer.
Right. Yeah. Scott Turow notwithstanding. Actually had a clip of the bit that you just referenced about stay close to your facts. This actor who's playing his editor is a total, hey, it's that guy.
He's a fake Cameron.
Yeah.
That's what I call him, is fake Cameron. Because he's like sort of the younger version of when you want to get Alan Ruck, but you can't. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like the Harry Anderson of, going to say of Canada, but I think Harry Anderson is also Canadian. But this guy is like, you know, fewer magic tricks. Anyway, he, here they are not being supportive of each other in the workplace in clip 4.
Yeah?
Hey.
Dave Miller scooped you.
What? Yeah, he met with your guy already.
Yeah, be in the Sun tomorrow.
Well, did you read the article?
No, not yet, but it doesn't matter because we don't have the exclusive anymore.
I just threatened the general in charge of the Thai Narcotics Suppression Bureau to get in to see this guy.
I know, but...
I'm writing my fucking article. You can put it on the front page or not. Just stay close to your facts.
Okay, wait. This is something I forgot to look this up. So is The Sun like the evening paper for the Globe and Mail, or are they unaffiliated?
I don't think they're
affiliated. Do we know the answer to this question? Okay, then Okay, so then this is something that doesn't make sense. There's no way that the editor would know about it. If this were the evening paper or something, then that's fine. Because a lot of times the morning and the evening paper are up against each other, and we'll be talking about that sort of how the silos compete with each other more when we are talking about our cold case. But if you don't know what another paper is working on something, and this is something that is not like an incredibly long lead thing, like, yeah, we've heard that, you know, Dave Miller's been investigating this for the last 3 months. This is a fast thing. There's no way you know. Like, you keep that locked down so fucking hard. No one would be sharing that and saying, oh, he talked to the guy and he got it in tomorrow. That was such a bullshit little script thing that was clearly there to just, like, create a ticking clock or create more tension or whatever. That annoyed me very much. I'm sorry to get so inside baseball-y about it, but that was my least favorite thing with this movie, and there are many things to have as your least favorite.
I liked the movie overall, but there were certain things where I felt like it had strengths and weaknesses. And one of its weaknesses was like it thinking that none of us had seen All the President's Men ever. Like, there are certain things that as a culture, we no longer have to do with exposition because we've all seen that movie. And we've also, like, we understand what it means to get locked up in Thailand on a drug offense. Like, there are certain things that you don't have to explain. Sometimes the movie is good and economical with this stuff, and sometimes it lets a moment breathe, and other times it just acts like we don't understand how journalism works. The point of that exchange, I think, is to underline that Malarek in particular is considered whatever journo non grata in Thailand because because he's dangerous and he's going to get the story. But like
we'd already gotten that. Like, that's the thing. Yeah. Isn't it? I mean, I feel like there are like this movie was 2 hours, and it was like it sometimes felt longer because I felt like there were these underscorings of things. There was this underscoring that, you know, okay, he's a wild man and he's not around and he is splitting his time between TV and the paper and like sort of inside baseball things that to me did not serve the main story, which is a true story of the cops really fucking up, one getting killed in the process and another person's life being destroyed. And, you know, like, and so going at, like, I also, you know, was like frustrated at the number of times that we hear that the incarcerated guy, he was really naive. He didn't get it. He didn't know what was going on. He wasn't really a player. He was just doing that. Like, you could have told me this once. You told me this once. I got it. You don't have to keep telling me these things.
Well, yeah, we got it. We definitely got it from like when they're putting in his name into their, you know, I-286 yeah. computer, and it comes up with all these aliases, and they're like, well, that's the guy. Like, is it though? Mm-hmm. And there's also, all right, the introduction to Jim Gaffigan, who I think does a good job in this part, given how much of his brand is like clean comedy. That N-word that he drops in that one scene was super jarring as a result.
Oh my God. I was filing my nails and I literally looked up with a shot of adrenaline when he said that word.
Yeah. I was like, oh no, not you. Like, I know you're playing a part. But in this scene, oh my God, it's like, is there some CanCon regulation by which if this guy is like sort of he's not even a kingpin, he's like a earl pin, and he has to like be paranoid and point the gun at this dude, and then the music cue in the background, like this is
I've been so excited about talking this scene.
No budget thriller, and yet they could afford this like iconic Miami Vice drug trade music clip. Here's clip two.
Where the fuck is it? Where the fuck is it? And what the fuck are you doing on my boat?
Hey, oh, he just got here, man. He's my buddy.
Oh, he's your buddy?
Yeah.
What the fuck are you asking me for money I owe
no,
you?
No, I was kidding, man. Just kidding.
This piece of shit. Where is my shit?
Probably in the bedroom where you leave all your stuff, man.
It's all been oh, shit. You guys look like you were gonna fucking shit your pants.
I mean, Gaffigan takes to this so easily, like the swearing. I think he does a great job with this, but that scene is like,
dude, this was Boogie Nights. This was the Alfred Molina scene in Boogie Nights. And I assure you that whoever was writing it, when they were directing it, whatever, they were saying, this is the Alfred Molina scene in Boogie Nights without, you know, Sister Christian or fireworks. This felt exactly like this to me. And this is another thing where it's just like, at a certain point in every adult's life, or not every adult, but most adults, you've been at someone's house, you know, to like pick up something and been like, oh no. You know, everyone has been in that scenario at one point or seen Boogie Nights. We don't need to do it again.
Yeah, we really don't, unless this is the side that you gave to Gaffigan's agent to be like, he gets to do XYZ in this thriller and wear ugly shirts and a gold chain and be a disgusting pig. Like, okay.
The greatest tragedy of the pandemic is not what I'm about to say, but I still wrote in my notes, the greatest tragedy of the pandemic is, it's not thousands of people have died in our countries and runs, but I really think that this was Jim Gaffigan's like big swing at the Philip Seymour Hoffman game.
Yeah.
I really do. I got that vibe big time, and that this movie wasn't in theaters and isn't going to get that sort of recognition, and that I haven't heard people saying like Jim Gaffigan about this makes me feel bad for him, because I felt like he was working his ass off and I was very compelled by his character. And the thing is, even though I'm bitching about how cliched that scene was, I was completely engaged the whole time. Maybe it's because In the Air Tonight's really zeitgeisty right now too, but I mean, I liked the character. I found the character interesting and engaging. Like, as a complicated, fucked up CI, I dug him. I dug Gaffigan in it. I want to see Gaffigan do more shit, but I feel bummed out because this, in a different time, would have been a four-year consideration role. And
yeah,
now I just
for
don't
sure.
know. Yeah, I mean, we would have seen ads like in The Reporter and people pushing that reel and him on talk shows and him on Seth Meyers being charming and all that. And I mean, I feel like, because of everything else, this movie just sort of, I mean, you can get it on $7 on Amazon. You know, this movie sort of dropped like into obscurity, and it's not fair to Gaffigan because this is a better performance than a lot of performances that have received award recognition in previous years.
Yeah, I agree. I was extremely impressed. I'm going to play a clip. Unfortunately, this is not a visual medium, but this very short scene was like both admirable and frustrating, because this is these guys just acting and not having to sort of chew through a lot of writing that's telling us stuff we already know or showing us scenes we've seen in other movies. There's a lot of silences in here, but what's happening is that Legere, who is played by Antoine Olivier Pilon, the copy of this movie we watched, there was some French that was not subtitled, so I was just like, okay, but then there's acting that happens in these scenes and you get it because film is a visual medium. But anyway, he is basically smoking a heroin joint, I think. And what you're not going to see when I play this clip, but what is on Gaffigan's face is like halfway to the Best Supporting Actor nomination. Mm-hmm. So here's clip three.
How long's it been? Months. Welcome home, friend.
So, as this is happening, there is a tear coming down Pilon's face because, you know, Legere has been clean and now is not again. And on Gaffigan's face is that, like, classic junkie, like, I feel bad that I've caved in your recovery, but also I feel selfishly good that I've dragged you down back here with me and I have company with it.
Yeah.
And now I can control you with that. And it's not something that you expect from Gaffigan necessarily. And I am into it. And I completely agree that this should get him some awards notice, and you and I are going to have to just, like, you know, stand on the top of Best Evidence with a cowbell and try to make it happen, because he's okay. really good in this.
He's like, okay, right? Like, is there anything I need to know about him? His comedy's never appealed to me. He's not like a sister wife guy or anything, like jerk off into plants guy or anything, is he?
I don't think so. I think he has many children.
Maybe that's why I said the sister wife thing. And well, the thing too that isn't fair is Josh Hartnett also does a really nice job. And not only is Josh Hartnett hobbled because he's playing like sort of the straight character where you don't get to do as much fun stuff, but Josh Hartnett is hobbled by the fact that the person he's playing is someone who's still around.
Yeah.
Now, the person that Jim Gaffigan's playing, if you stick around to the end of the movie, you'll see that the CI basically, because part of the deal with the story is that the reason this young person who was basically just a junkie and who didn't know anybody and who wasn't a player and like ended up being served up to the authorities was that this guy had a pay-to-play deal with the Canadian cops where he could get like 40K, 50K, something like that every time he served up someone that they could prosecute. Yeah. So, I mean, so this whole situation, and this is true. I mean, this movie, even though there are a lot of things that are sort of dramatized, stuck to the facts well enough that I'm, you know, not going to complain and say, you know, it stuck to the facts like at a Hustler's level. You know what
yeah.
I mean? Like,
yeah.
There was like plenty of stuff that they stuck in there to make it more fun and make it a good story, but it wasn't like our next movie or something where it's unrecognizable. But Gaffigan, you know, A, that's a more fun character to play, and B, that guy disappeared after he served
up.
Yeah. The guy. And I mean, I did a little bit of investigating and it's like, for real, like nobody ever heard about him again. And I can start to develop some QAnon theories, but this isn't the InfoWars podcast, so I won't.
It certainly isn't. The extent to which I think this movie sometimes, like, how you sell a movie like this is like on the comparisons to All the President's Men, I suspect. So it's a little harder once you've sold it that way, like once you've pitched it that way, to really get into what the actual story is, which is that everybody involved except Leger is like absolutely straining the definition of a crime to its utmost until it snaps. Like, the CI is exaggerating how connected Leger is in Thailand. Leger keeps trying to tell them he can only get them however many kilos, which is not going to be the big bus they need, but they decide to just take it because they went all the way there. And then the deal starts going south, but nobody pulls the plug because, like, everybody needs there to be a major case so badly that then it turns into a major case, but it's not really a major drug case. It's a major incompetence and corruption fuck up case. So,
and you know, but that's the thing too, is that I felt like all the stuff with the cops was really interesting, like how they played it. Like, I never really, you know, the cops weren't saying like, oh, I'm going to get this guy because he's a piece of shit, or I'm going to get this guy because I want to get drugs off the street. It all just sort of seemed to come down to budget. This was a $1 million, you know, we got $1 million budget for this. We can't come home with nothing. We got to do this. We're going to bring your son into less than zero the shit out of this and say some horrible things about Asians. You know, things like that, I thought it was interesting to play the cops that way, like as bureaucrats, as opposed to like a Training Day, end of watch, you know, bastards.
Yeah.
And I liked that too. No one's saying I'm fucking King Kong or I'm, you know, whatever, or, you know, no one was planting evidence. And I liked that because it started to make me think about, and this is something I've obviously, you know, you and I have both been thinking about a lot lately, is sort of like the complicity in popular culture and in true crime culture in enabling police misbehavior. And it's something that I will always be grateful that when I wrote for you and for Tara at Previously TV, that a lot of times you would let me complain about that when I was covering shows that had nothing to do with police misbehavior, that I'd bitch about cops that would go too far. No, because other editors, I think, would have like cut that out as like irrelevant. So I've always appreciated that with you, Sarah. So I'm going to say that on the record right
look
here.
Look at us. But, okay.
Yeah. Hey, look at
I'll
this.
I'll take that We're W.
But, you know, I like that the movie played it this way as opposed to being cartoony, because I think that now that we are hearing more and more about police brutality, for every time it is a maniac cop kneeling on someone's neck, it's just as often someone who's bringing somebody in, because if you arrest someone at 5:30, that means you get to stay for 2.5 more hours and get overtime all that time.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Bureaucracy is as much a part of the systemic, you know, racism and oppression that we're seeing from police officers as, you know, just cops being, you know, jackbooted thugs.
In fact, the sort of pyramid scheme that is the budgeting of these police departments. And like, there have been many, many, many stories about comp stat in NYPD that just like indicates that it's just like not Amway, but like that you're just sort of trying to flow numbers upward to justify your budget. And I also thought that they did a good job underplaying, or not underplaying, but just they had the right touch with the father-son relationship here, and that the dad is this like exhausted, doesn't really care anymore and just wants the W so that his boss will get off his back older guy. And then his son is this like racist jackass, and that guy was cast perfectly, and that was a really good performance.
Oh God, when he had the Wayfarers on. Oh my God. It was so perfect. Well, and you know, the guy who played his dad, that's McHattie.
Yes.
Right. He played the Zodiac a couple of years ago
some
dumb thing that I barely even remember, but I think you and I maybe talked about when we were just like talking about how there's too much Zodiac stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, so like, you know, it was nice to see a lot of sort of, a lot of these people are sort of recognizable journeyman actors, where when you go and look at their IMDb thing, you'll be like, oh my God, 214 things. And it's, you know, it's the Law and Order, it's the Criminal Intent, it's the Criminal Minds.
It's like that thing on Sci-Fi that, you know, nobody watched, and it was like, oh, the Vancouver, you know, the Vancouver content farm.
Yeah. What the fuck is October Faction? Well, everyone was on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Hartnett is good. And I think he faces the challenges that you say. He hilariously, like, Gaffigan seems to have no problem reeling off a string of swears and racial epithets. Meanwhile, Hartnett really seems to like not struggle, but it doesn't seem as natural when he's swearing. Here's a scene in which he's trying to be the badass. And you know what's funny to me, like in this role, what and how he is sort of like inhabiting it physically, he reminds me of a colleague of mine who is a like professor of English at Middle Tennessee State University. And it's like very, I mean, it's very weird to see that. And then to have him be cursing, like, not that my colleague doesn't curse, like we're friends. So obviously he swears some. But here is Malarek sort of realizing that this is not the guy anyone thinks it is or wants it to be in clip 5.
All right, listen. Somehow I convinced my paper to send me down here to interview this criminal mastermind who managed to get himself locked up. But see, I don't think he's a criminal mastermind.
Yeah, why not?
Because everyone who knows him says the same thing. Daniel Leger is just a low-life junkie who lies like he breathes, and the only point in life is to get fucked up.
Just something about the, like, fucked up. Like, I just felt like that was take 7 or something. Like, who is the speech for? Like, we already are here.
Yeah.
Do we need to see the reporter, like, arriving at this juncture? I mean, I don't know.
But then, like, when he confronts the cop outside the hotel, he feels more dangerous to me, too. There was sort of a schism in how he personified the role at various times that, I mean, I wasn't sure what was going on or if there were reshoots or something like that, because it, I don't know, like, it wasn't, the guy he was talking to in front of the hotel, like, that cop, I wanted that guy more, because I kind of love that guy.
Yeah. And I also wanted, here's a snip, which is a little bit long, but it's our last clip for this section. And it sort of embodies how I feel about this movie, which is that there's some good acting happening and there's some things that it was correct to leave this amount of information exactly where it was and not give me any more, even though it was based on real life. And I would sort of like to know more about how Malorex interfacing with Canadian DCFS as a kid, it mm-hmm. informed his various, narrative interests. But it also has some pretty I don't know. This is not necessarily how married people talk to each other, is A. And B, can we fucking not with the disapproving wives? You married this. You fucked it and pulled the goalie. I don't know what you thought was going to happen. I understand that you don't want to be threatened and have to live in a safe house. And I get it. But you married this. Oh my God, please stop. Anyway, here is clip six, in which I think Hartnett does a great job with a role that is asking him to be along two different axes at once a lot of the time, and he does pretty well. Here's clip six.
What?
It obviously doesn't matter what I say.
Of course it matters what you say. It's just that Leger's out there on his own. I mean, what am I supposed to do, leave him out there to rot? Come on.
You can't save everybody. You have a daughter, Neil.
What if it was our daughter? Out there.
It's not.
Well, what if it was, and she was dying in a Thai prison, and the government had abandoned her?
Like you were? This whole thing isn't about Leger or her daughter. It's about you. But this guy isn't you. Okay, when social services took you away, you were a kid. You were innocent. This guy's a criminal, for Christ's
sake. The government fucked him over. I know what it feels like to have the shit kicked out of you every day. And to wonder if anybody is ever going to come look out for you. No one ever does.
There was something about that line. Okay, first of all, they're at a friend's house for dinner, and he immediately comes in after that line and is like, hope everyone's hungry. Like, oh my God. Really?
Also, when I was watching it, I hadn't noticed that it was like the Hannibal dinner scene music playing in the background too. It was very distracting to me just now.
Yeah, he like comes out with the roast with like the little hats on the legs, and I was like, oh Jesus. But there was something about the delivery of no one ever does that I just thought was great. Like I was very, I like paused it and was like, that was nice work. Like this scene is really kind of garbage time tropey exposition in which people are doing really good work. And that's kind of where I'm at with this movie. Like, I am not angry that I watched it. I think it brought me a lot of information about some actors that is good. This Pilon kid, he's like 30. I hope he does more work that we see. I hope Gaffigan gets attention for this. I'd still do it with Josh Hartnett, especially with the mustache and the kind of like loose faded jeans. I don't know. I'm into it. Like that Professor Sheik thing. I would. It's time to forgive him for Here on Earth. It's not his,
you know what,
fault.
It is. I think you saw that series, The Paper Chase, at exactly the right time in your life,
and that's what
you're sort of stuck with.
I mean, really,
because his look is very Paper Chase to me.
It's very Paper Chase. Like I think all of his ties were knitted. Which,
you come in here with a brain full of mush, and you come out a lawyer.
Oh, we should watch that for a future installment, although I don't think there's a crime there.
It's probably some crimes that it's probably some crimes of sexual harassment that we probably aren't aware of. I think that if people liked Killing the Messenger, which is a movie that I'm really ambivalent about because I'm familiar with a lot of the players in it personally. If you liked Killing the Messenger, which is the movie about the reporter who uncovered the Iran-Contra stuff, and a lot of CIA sort of misbehavior, and was you know, not just not supported by his editors, but told he was full of shit to the point where he killed himself. Sorry, spoiler alert for Killing the Messenger. If you liked that movie, I think that you'll like this movie. And in fact, I think that in a lot of ways, you'll find this movie superior because it's not trying so hard to be prestige-y. And it has like a lot of the same DNA, like a guy who is, you know, who doesn't want to give up on stuff and is a bit of a dog with a bone. And you're never really sure if he's fighting the fight because, you know, he's fighting for justice or because he's fighting for his own attention. And at a certain point when you're watching the movie, you think, oh, that's fine. I don't care.
Yeah. I mean, I like a movie that can put the reporter at the center, but also acknowledge that it's not, you know, it's not all like cake and roses. I mean, if you watched The Post and you were like, this is too, I don't know, like this is too PG. I think it's good. I don't think it's great, but there's a lot of good stuff in it. And I think it should get more attention so that more people can talk about it with us. Do you want to pay full price for it? I don't know, but it's 2020. I don't think you'll have to wait that long for it to show up on a streamer. So,
I mean, it's $7, which is, I mean, $7 is a lot when you're thinking like, am I going to have a job next month? But still, like when you're sitting at home and you're like, am I going to do this or watch, you know, whatever, like something terrible, watch The Floor is Lava again. Yeah. $7 suddenly seems like a manageable thing. I do not feel bad about the idea of spending $7 on it.
Yeah. If you can find a way to write it off somehow, like we can, all the better. I think it's really more of like a $4 or $5 investment, but I still like generally out in the world recommend it.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Moving on to I guess, sort of groundbreaking. Well, whatever. Let me play the cold case theme and then we'll talk about it. I reviewed on Best Evidence last week that Schechter book ripped from the headlines, which was just like a list of all these dramas that were based on or inspired by real crimes. So I thought that While the City Sleeps would be a fun one to do. I forget how I got there out of the entire table of contents, but the crime that inspired this is William Hirons, who is the, you know, stop me before I kill again, lipstick killer. This is not really about the crime, this movie. This is about jockeying for power in a media company. As such, I found it very relatable, but also wanted to scream many times. Here is the case file from the IMDb. Quote, a serial killer has been killing beautiful women in New York, and the new owner of a media company offers a high-ranking job to the first of his senior executives who can get the earliest scoops on the case. End quote. That the new owner is played by Vincent Price is probably enough to sell you on this concept. This is from the golden age of on-screen cynicism about, mixed with fanish depictions of, newspapermen. And from the great Fritz Lang comes a tale of a relatively hapless Gotham media scion, played by Price, who sees a string of vicious murders as a chance to cast his next capo regime, and the guys fighting for the job who play right into it. This is definitely a, like, LA Warner Brothers soundstage version of New York, and yet they put New York institution marquees in a chase scene. Like, what? Like, where is this supposed to be? I found that very odd. That'll be in the visual aids, which you will find on Twitter and Instagram at Blotter Presents. It's like really such a teeny thing and only for New Yorkers, but I'm like, so why don't you just put it on East 30th instead of East 3rd? Like, the addresses were all wrong to like a Law and Order degree. It was weird. I found this enjoyable, but I'm not sure it does what it sets out to do. What did you think of the movie overall?
Well, I watched both of our movies in quick succession, and the first thing I was struck by is how the movie from 1956 did such a better job with women than the movie from this year.
Yeah.
In terms of having interesting female characters who, even, you know, though this movie had lots of misogynistic stuff as part because of the times, even as part of the movie, bridled against the misogyny of the times and were allowed to bridle against it, as opposed to just like, oh, honey, why do you do this hard job?
Yeah, it's true. Like, they're in the mix, and the guy ends up, he's not caught because of this, but one of his prospective victims does manage to fight him off by screaming real loud and wanging him on the head with a huge ashtray, which let's hear it for the times when you smoked indoors. Otherwise, she'd be dead.
Well, I mean, I think that, too, like, Fritz Lang's sensibility in mine, I dig that. I dig his sense of camp. I dig, like, the sort of the wit and sort of, like, the fucked up spin he puts on a lot of stuff. I mean, whatever. Breaking news, Vincent Price is, you know, always seems to play characters who are not like on the hard heterosexual side of the Kinsey scale. And this role is no exception. There's some knee socks. There's this chain bracelet. There's the fact that it's Vincent Price. And like, they really sort of revel in a lot of this. If they revel in drunkenness, they revel in infidelity and sexual bullshit. And I liked and appreciated that even though this movie is ostensibly about a multiple murderer, or whatever they called them back before they said serial killer, and we're going to get to this in a second, but that even though the movie's about that, ostensibly, they didn't really like revel in like the degrading aspects of being murdered by someone. Like, they did not exploit attacks on women or whatever the killer did to them or whatever else. Like, they didn't get dirty with that in the way that I kind of expected from Fritz Lang, you know, the progenitor of Hitchcock. And so I liked that. I liked that it was a lot more sort of like His Girl Friday-ish than like Frenzy.
Oh, God. Well, yeah, there is a sort of inadvertently campy shot, which you will also see that in the visual aids of like the chalk outline of a victim that is sort of like slumped over the side of the bed. And it's just like, it has this like Zucker Abrams feel to it. I maybe inadvertently, but maybe not. Like, Fritz Lang does have a sort of wry sensibility about a lot of this, including our first clip in which Vincent Price's father has died like seriously 10 minutes before that. And he's hauled. He's like hauled all the big wigs into his office to, first of all, ask what they do. And they're all looking at each other like, asshole says what? Like, we've all been in this meeting where all of a sudden your division is headed up by the boss's kid or someone's college friend with a background in marketing. And you're like, oh my fucking God. So, that's this meeting. I found myself cringing in recognition. Clip 7.
You are Mark Loving.
That's right.
Just what do you do around here?
I run Kine Newswire Service, KNS. I presume you've checked our handling of your father's death. Any suggestions?
The Newswire. Yes. We must talk about that soon. You must be, John Day Griffith.
I sweep up the floor. And I'm editor of the Sentinel. I'm also advisory editor of the other 9 papers.
Are you responsible for the fact that a cheap murder was featured on the same front page as the death of my father?
The old man wanted the story played up big. Of course, he didn't know then he was going to be news. But inasmuch as it was his last request...
Walter, I've arranged a copyrighted feature on the old man's life. Shall I give it to Mark to send over the wire?
We'll see.
That last guy is boning Vincent Price's wife. So, yeah. He also looks like the poor man's Clark Gable, which is probably exactly what he was. The long pauses, like when it sounds like he's checking his notes, that's literally what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Like, Citizen Kine over here has no idea that these titans of New York media, like who they are, what they do. It's kind of amazing. Then Lachlan Trump comes up with this idea where he's going to pit the three of them against each other for this new position that he's made up that basically will do his job for him. And it's based on scoops in the story. And I just found myself thinking about Bill James's popular crime a lot. And this, like the ways in which Bill James, who is also the father of baseball sabermetrics, was trying to like quantify what makes a story take off. What makes a Jodi Arias or a, like, what are the variables that makes a story take off? And then how much of it is driven by supply versus demand? And I just kept thinking about this and like the role of the media in creating a story that they then are like, well, the demand is there. And, you know, OJ being the prime example of that, I guess, that it's like someone stopped the cycle.
Well, and like these days, I think, too, you hear about in digital, right? Like they call it, I mean, Brian Goldberg, the guy who runs like Bustle Media Group, I think that you can't like read a story where he's interviewed where he doesn't say flooding the zone, right? And that's like where you just cover something until people stop clicking. Because now, too, not only are like, you know, the thing that irritated me when he said, you know, my dad's death shared the front page with this murder, the first thing that I thought, because I'm old, is, well, yeah, if you want to drive single copy sales, which still there are people in newsrooms that are thinking about that, you're going to have the murder above the fold and your dad's death below the fold, because your dad's death is not going to drive a single copy sale the way, scandalous seeming homicide is, even though, yeah. I assume that there's plenty of homicides, but this is a good one.
Yeah. The economics of it. And it's something that certainly has been preoccupying a lot of us even more than it was before this like 5-year long year. But I think that there really was in the 50s, there was like a whole bunch of movies that were interrogating the role of the media in like creating and sort of perpetuating stories for its own survival, the same way that we were talking in the previous section about these cases being blown up and perpetuated and clung to for the police's and the budget's own survival, that there's this like Moebius of like generative fuckery. That's not a thing, but just go with it. That is this, you know, it's the same, but then there's a turn somewhere around Watergate from thinking that newspaper men are, doing their best in a flawed system and we have to hold up a mirror to the, you know, reporters, to like crusaders who are uncovering crime that took place in smoky back rooms and so on. And going from the first sort of newspaper story in our first section to this sort was sort of interesting. What's the one with Kirk Douglas? Ace in the Hole?
I think so, yeah. Oh my God, I haven't thought about that one in a long time.
No, me neither. And it was at least 5 years ago pretty hard to find. But like stories like that were really kind of asking like, how are these newspaper men becoming, or like getting into the story? How are they becoming the story? So anyway.
Well, and I think that that's the germ of the idea that is what actually links it. Is it pronounced Hirons? The actual Hirons case, like the real lipstick killer case. Because, you know, when there's the Wikipedia page on the case is a very good one and it's very detailed. And if you're interested in it, I suggest you go look at it. We can put it in the show. Yeah. But the thing that sort of that allows, I think, this movie to claim that it has anything to do with the actual case is how strong the press's influence was in the conviction of this guy, where when you start to like sort of go through everything, you're like, did he do this? Huh? Now, one of the reasons that they probably didn't hew too closely to the actual case is because one of the victims was a six-year-old child whose pieces were left all over Chicago.
Yeah.
This is where the case actually took place. But so a lot of the arrest and trial was like sort of this battle between the Tribune, the Hearst paper, which I can't remember what it was called, and the other Chicago paper at the time, which I can't remember what it was called either. All these papers are dead now. And all of these papers were up against each other and covering the story ad nauseum. There were like these things where there would be two different pictures of the suspect, one with his hair all messy and one of them, you know, combed over to sort of suggest, you know, the early days of, keep in mind, this is 4 years before Psycho came out. So it really makes you think about how much of this shit that, you know, Hitchcock ended up lifting.
Right.
But, you know, that there's like these two faces to this killer and, you know, all this other stuff that, you know, that this movie doesn't really go into, but the sort of the DNA, not that DNA was an issue back then, but the DNA of this, how the press is behind getting an arrest or getting something to happen is, I think, sort of the through line between the actual case and this sort of weird movie.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, speaking of Bill James, I think he is maybe one of the people who was like, it does seem like maybe Hirons didn't do any of these or didn't do all of these, which, you know, the sort of disparity in age and, like, I don't like this phrase, but target selection would seem to indicate that perhaps something is amiss. In any case, you do see many years before John Douglas and Robert Ressler acted like they invented or at least codified profiling, you do see some in this movie that is, you know, fairly accurate. It's what you'd expect from an episode of Mindhunter, but this is the 50s. Also, comic books are being blamed for, you know, inciting violence. And Hirons is mentioned in that way that Law and Order has of, like, acknowledging what headlines you think this was ripped from before they do a little twist on it. So here's clip 9.
I was just looking for possible points of comparison with this Felton case.
Look for a young guy, Bert.
Now you're guessing.
Premeditated murder by a psycho, and not his first. He didn't leave any fingerprints.
So he wore gloves. Anyone who leaves fingerprints nowadays, even on his first homicide, can't even read. You know how much stuff is written and published for the instruction of potential lawbreakers? Take the so-called comic books, sold to kids of all ages in drugstores and... Why do you say this killer is young?
The lipstick bit.
Well, there's nothing new about that. Several years
now. I know. What was it? Catch me. I can't control myself.
This one only changed the lyrics. Ask Mother.
He's a mama's boy, unless I'm mistaken.
Well, the message may have been a blind.
I think it's an impertinence. He's laughing at the police by leaving clues. But no fingerprints.
Keep on talking. In the old days, before you were above writing about crime, you and I used to be pretty good together.
What do you think of the dresser drawers found open?
We searched the janitor's room. We didn't find anything. Of course, we don't know that anything was stolen.
I mean, I could have listened to those two basically flirting for like 20 minutes. That was pretty great. But I was really struck by, like, these are things that you would not necessarily expect from a 1956 picture. They're doing profiling. They understand that the facts that are released in news stories matter. Okay, the comic book blaming is unfortunate, but they also are like, well, the drawers are rifled through for whatever that means. Anyone would have to be an idiot to leave fingerprints. I mean...
Well, and there's another scene where they're talking to the police, and the police are talking about, well, we got hair. And I'm like, well, what are you going to do with the hair? You don't have DNA yet. But they were talking about hair. They were talking about fingerprints again and all that. And once again, like, I was pleasantly surprised at sort of that they were acknowledging, you know, that collection of evidence, it was a thing, and it wasn't. And, you know, and this is a note that you made that I'm about to steal. John Douglas didn't invent the whole idea of all of this shit. Like, sure, nobody says serial killer because that was not part of the vocabulary yet. And right. It was interesting because I kept waiting for someone to say serial killer. Then I was like, oh, no, wait, you know, no one said that yet. But everyone basically said it. Well, he's done it before. This is someone who keeps killing people. You know, serial killer is sort of a shorter way to say that. But it does sort of make you think, like, John Douglas, you know, we all had access to these movies too.
Yeah. And you really wonder, like, there are so many writers about sort of pre-Ted Bundy law enforcement's attempts to apprehend, in all the senses of that word, serial killers, and they just sort of make the point over and over again, like, you have to understand, cops did not think of crimes in series this way. There was, like, enduring linkage blindness. And then you see these sort of investigative assumptions made by this movie from, like, 20 years before Bundy, or 15 or 20 years before Bundy, that they're just like, well, but this. And they're familiar with the concept of a sexual sadist escalating, which we'll hear about that in the next clip. But, like, these are just, like, you know, they're crime reporters and investigators, and they see this stuff all the time, and they've drawn their own conclusions. And then there's John Douglas being like, nobody thought about it this way before we came along. And it's like, well, okay, well, nobody even, used those terms for it, but, you know, you also maybe didn't solve the Atlanta child murders correctly with your profiling, so don't be taken. So much credit.
When you look at some of the coverage of, you know, the Hirons case, which once again, there's a strong argument to be made that police helped make some of the facts fit the narrative.
Right.
But when you look at some of the coverage, and that was 10 years before, because that case actually, like, sort of started, kicked off in 45. It's exactly that same sort of thing. This is a person. We believe that this person has this problem. We believe that this person had this relationship with their parents and all that. I mean, the mother stuff, all that shit too, you know, like, and that's the other thing is in, you know, at the very end of Psycho, when they're talking about Norman Bates and, he's like this kind of person because this kind of relationship, once again, it's like everybody had all these ideas. John Douglas just sort of repackaged it, which, I mean, maybe that's just the triumph of white men and bureaucracy, is they repackage ideas that are already out there and everyone praises them. But
well, and he does. I mean, in the cases that haunt us, he does acknowledge that there were some cases from earlier in the 20th century and even the late 19th century. But the one he points to is that sort of, he calls it a primitive profile, although I thought it was actually pretty sophisticated, of Hauptmann in the Lindbergh case. But it's look, people might have been doing this based on, like, head shape, and there was all the racism in the practice of phrenology, and, you know, we didn't have the science of in some ways at the time, but, like, the idea that you could guess someone's personality based on their handwriting, it goes back to, like, 3000 BC. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, but John Douglas, he's a promoter. If he's not good at anything else. Let's hear that last clip, which is where I was really, where I really sort of sat up and was like, 1956 this came out? Because, again, it's not like they're trying to sell the audience on this concept or explain it. It's assumed. So here's clip 10.
We've run onto the record of a string of unsolved burglaries committed months ago. We think that's the way this boy may have started. He steals only ladies' things from lone, unprotected girls. This guy's a real nut on dames.
And this description begins to fit Mobley.
Albert, I know our next move. Put Nancy's picture in the paper or use her on the telecast.
Oh, no, you don't. Print Mildred's picture. Use her.
Where are you going?
Out of your life.
So she storms out, and this waiter who's by the door, who is clearly used to dodging upset women, is like, woo, with his tray of martinis. She, like, he smooched Mildred, played by Ida Lupino. And that's why this lady is torqued. They end up getting married and he gets the executive director job. Spoiler. But I still think you all should rent this movie because it's Fritz Lang. If you enjoy mid-century decor, as I do, you will find many things to try to source on Etsy. And it's fascinating for how little has changed in some ways. Like, is our science better and more advanced and a little faster? Yes. But there's a lot of stuff that the FBI would have you believe if they didn't invent it, they perfected it in the 70s. That's already being done here. There is a brief, but I felt pretty withering comment about the way police interrogations were conducted. Like, a light is literally shining in the guy's face and he is in a like wreath of cops with hats on who are smoking like right in his face. You know, women have some agency in the story despite the baked in misogyny of the 50s. Yeah, I thought it was fascinating. And then Vincent Price, like, does not appear to necessarily be in the same movie as everybody else, but that's not a bad thing. I don't know. What do you recommend?
Ida Lupino was fantastic. Yes. She's great. I mean, she is a grown ass woman who is, you know, she's a woman from another time who is stuck in this world and has decided to rock it out. And yep. I dug her character 100%. There are some great outfits. Drew Barrymore's dad plays the killer. And so this is like a fun thing. He was still billed at the time as John Barrymore Jr. He changed his name to John Drew Barrymore about 2 years later. And that's where Drew got her name, obviously. But you see this guy and you're like, you can see Drew Barrymore in his face. It is interesting, you know, because he was so young. And, you know, the Barrymores, they had such a rough time and all that. He barely has any lines, but still, he is compelling.
Yeah.
Like, there is something about this guy where you see him and he's compelling. It's also, like, something I liked about this movie that has nothing to do with true crime or whatever is how you could tell at this point they still didn't know quite what to do with broadcast news. The main news guy, the guy who, you know, who just basically said, hey, we're going to use my fiance as bait.
Yes, Mobley, played by Dana Stevens, who admitted later that he was drunk during the entire shooting of this. But because it was the mid-50s and he's a reporter, you can't even tell.
But so he's a broadcast reporter. And, you know, like, that's something that, like, you could tell that they weren't sure how to handle. It's just interesting, especially comparing it with the other movie that we also watched, where there's this newspaper reporter who was also spending his time with TV, and there's this sort of like conflict, like, do you want to be a TV reporter or do you want to be a newspaper reporter?
Yeah.
What do you want to do? And, like, you know, the 50s, obviously TV had been around for a bit by then, but they weren't quite sure enough, I think, about where broadcast news was heading to do a lot with it. So Dana Stevens sort of played it like a newspaper journalist in a lot of ways, but he wasn't really. He was a guy who sat behind a desk and talked into a camera. And so it was interesting to me, just as someone who has always, you know, had TV and broadcast journalism is like just as significant in a lot of ways as text journalism, you know, all of our lives, right? Seeing a time when they weren't quite sure what to do with it yet.
Yeah,
that was interesting.
And that they sort, there wasn't sort of this acknowledgement that it's different skill sets. So you'd have like reporters sort of like with a little scoop card in their hats, just like reading their stories on a mic. And you're like, well, okay, but that's not exactly like, what's the point of that? How does this use the medium?
Well, like clip nine, the one where the guy blames the comic book. The thing is, you could trade that for 2020 or 60 Minutes instead of comic books if you'd made this movie, you know, 25 years later.
Right.
You could have said that, you know, everything on Oxygen gives you a handbook on how to do true crime. So, you know, that line is timeless, but it's, like, they didn't know it yet, but watching it, knowing what we know, that broadcast was going to become the new handbook for killers is, I think, sort of interesting and they didn't get it yet. But the other thing is, I feel like this is a good time to get into old movies, and not just because soon we're going to be out of new ones.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I really feel like right now, like this time for all of us, we're at home, there's just less going on. And we all, by virtue of our, there should be less going on. Stay at home, everybody. It's not over. Like, we all have to be a little more patient and can't be as attention deficit-y as we might have been another time. So this is a time, even though this movie moves fast. I mean, this movie rocks it out in, it's like an hour and a half.
Yeah, but, that's the thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like car chases or anything like that, but like, it's like, it's a good ride, but this is a good time to go back and look at the Fritz Lang and the Hitchcock and all the other stuff that you sort of like were like, oh, I was supposed to watch that for film class, but I didn't. You will enjoy it. I feel like you will discover things, and a lot of it's a lot racier than you expected, and a lot of it moves a lot faster than you expected, but you might not have given it a chance if you had other options. So this is a good time to sort of look back at that again and see the genesis of a lot of what we consume now.
Yeah, I definitely recommend this. It's available on Amazon for rent. It's on iTunes as well, I think. There will be a link in the show notes to its page on justwatch.us, which will tell you where you can find it. And we would love to hear from you guys about where you think this, how bright this movie star is in the firmament of journalism and crime films. And also, if you agree that there was this turn at Watergate from these movies being reporter as crime fighter to reporter as like the story. So I'm not sure I articulated that particularly well, but that's why they're not making these movies about me. All right, Eve, thank you so much for enjoying this double feature with me. And I feel like we should do another one like this because there's really a ton of 50s and 60s movies like this that we could dig into.
Well, I was thinking about it too. Like something that might be fun to do again is if we do like another sort of double where we have like a, like, yeah, like the sort of more current version of something and the old version of something. And the more current version, we get like a Tiger Beatty guy. And the old version, you know, we get sort of whoever was the Tiger Beatty guy of that era.
Yeah.
I feel like we could, I mean, there's sort of an endless supply of people who are now tackling ripped from the headlines stories that we could do sort of a twofer with again. And I think it would be a lot of fun.
Yeah, let's do it. And again, yeah, listeners, we welcome those suggestions. Don't forget, you can call or text those suggestions in at 919-75-CRIME.
In local news today, bees.
Nope. Eve, besides Best Evidence, where else can listeners find you?
Well, if listeners want to be listeners, you get an Eve Beatty a double shot in your ears this week, because not only am I guesting on the podcast you're listening to right now, I am also one of the guests on the Eater's Digest podcast. Ooh. I know, right? All I do this week is talk into a microphone, which Eater's Digest, it's easy to find. It's the podcast for Eater.com, which is, that's my day job. I am the editor at Eater San Francisco. And so we cover, you know, obviously we have a lot to talk about right now, but I'm on Eater's Digest this week talking about people eating inside tents in San Francisco, $200 sushi meals while troubled people mill about outside. And what's the latest with delivery apps, most specifically Uber in California. So very different than what we're talking about here, but what can I say, guys? I'm eclectic.
There will be a link to that in the show notes, and there will also be a link in case one of the other four people who cares about Marquee's as a New York institution, which closed in November of last year, but I have been there, and that olive plate was something that haunts the dreams. That will also be in our show notes right below this podcast. Eve, thank you again.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Toby Ball will be talking about HBO's Nexium 9-parter, The Vow, followed by first-time guest Reality Blurred's Andy Daynart on love fraud and TV copaganda. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you could find me on social media. That's Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, like I said, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscribers get extra reviews, so sign up today. My guest has been Eve Beatty, and she is on Twitter at EveB. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.